There's a conversation that repeats itself constantly online. Which fictional universe would you live in? Which power would you pick? Which faction would you join? And every version of that conversation makes the same mistake. It assumes these worlds were built with your survival in mind. They weren't. Today we're ranking 12 fictional worlds by one metric. How completely, how fast, and how irreversibly does each one destroy a regular human being? We go from bad to incomprehensibly worse. Let's begin. Silent Hill needs no introduction. Everyone's seen Pyramid Head, even if they've never touched a controller. What most people don't fully clock is exactly why it works as horror, because the answer is more precise than it looked. What the game's established from the start is that Silent Hill is not haunted in any conventional sense. It doesn't have a demon in the basement or ghosts attached to a specific tragedy. The horror is psychological in a precise and literal way. The town reads whoever enters it and generates an experience tailored to that specific person's psychology. Whatever you carry inside, unprocessed grief, repressed guilt, shame you've never faced, fears you've organized your life around avoiding, Silent Hill inventories all of it and builds a world from the contents. Pyramid Head is the clearest illustration of how this works. That creature did not exist as a fixed resident of Silent Hill before the protagonist of the second game, James Sunderland, arrived. The town created it from James's own psychology, specifically from guilt he couldn't consciously process about killing his terminally ill wife. The executioner aesthetic, the enormous punishing blade, the way it dominates the other creatures in front of James, all of it maps precisely onto what James needed psychologically in terms of punishment. The town ran a diagnostic and manufactured an executioner from the results. Now, apply that to yourself. You don't need James Sunderland's specific tragedy to activate the mechanic. The town works with available material, unresolved grief, guilt about decisions from years ago, anxieties you've organized your life around avoiding. Silent Hill doesn't need a dramatic backstory. It needs the ordinary accumulated psychological debt of being a person who has lived for any meaningful length of time, which means it needs almost nothing. The other world is the second layer. At unpredictable moments, the town shifts into its alternate state, a rusted industrial dimension where every surface is in the process of decaying into something worse, and the laws of architecture stop functioning. Corridors loop. Rooms lead to spaces that shouldn't exist geometrically. What's important is that the other world isn't a separate dimension the town slips into randomly. According to the lore, it's the town's actual state. The foggy semi-normal version is the suppressed one. When the sirens sound, you're seeing what was always underneath. The surviving characters across the franchise illustrate this consistently. Heather Mason, protagonist of Silent Hill 3, carries the effects of the town's influence in ways that manifest as fragmented identity long after she's physically left. Henry Townjund in Silent Hill 4 doesn't even enter the town in any traditional sense. The town comes to him, his apartment becoming an access point for the other world while he's inside it. The common thread is that the psychological restructuring the town performs doesn't reverse cleanly upon exit. Some find elements of their experience bleeding into ordinary perception. Others lose the ability to distinguish between the town's constructed reality and the one they return to. And here's the detail most people miss when they think about surviving Silent Hill. The town is not trying to kill you in most cases. It's trying to process you, work through your guilt or trauma or repressed material with you as the raw material for the processing. Some characters come through that and achieve something like resolution. Most don't. And the ones who don't either die in the town or come out the other side with the kind of psychological damage that doesn't have a treatment protocol. Silent Hill sits at 12 because the horror still registers you as an individual. It's building something specific for you. It knows you're there, and it's paying attention to you specifically. Everything above this on the list is working at a scale where your individual psychology is not a variable that matters to anything. Attack on Titan is a manga by Hajime Isayama that ran from 2009 to 2021. The premise? Humanity has been reduced to living inside three enormous concentric walls because outside those walls, the world is populated by titans. Gigantic humanoid creatures ranging from 3 to 15 meters tall that eat people. The walls are named Maria, Rose, and Sina. They've held for over 100 years, long enough that most of the civilian population has normalized their existence. The Survey Corps is the military branch responsible for operating outside the walls. Getting in requires finishing at the top of a years-long training program. The equipment? Vertical maneuvering gear that allows three-dimensional movement using gas-powered grappling hooks takes years to master. The psychological preparation required to accept probable death and function effectively anyway is something most people can't achieve even with training. The Survey Corps still loses people constantly on every expedition. You have none of what they have, The Titans themselves are not sophisticated. Pure Titans don't coordinate, don't plan, don't use tools or tactics. They detect human presence and move toward it, and they eat. What Isayama established early is that Titans don't need to eat to survive. They have no functional digestive system. They eat and eventually expel it. The consumption serves no biological need, which removes every conventional leverage point you'd apply to a predator. You can't wait for them to be full. You can't redirect them toward easier prey. You can't make yourself not worth the effort. The behavior is categorical, not caloric. The wall breach sequence in the early chapters shows exactly what this world looks like for civilians without the walls. Immediate, massive death with no capacity for response. Nothing a civilian has access to stops something 15 meters tall. Nowhere to run once the perimeter is gone. The full story reveals an additional layer that changes the entire survival calculus. Pure Titans are transformed humans. People of Eldian ancestry, an ethnic group that Marley has been persecuting and interning for generations, who were injected with a serum that forced the transformation and then thrown over Wall Maria to wander as Titans indefinitely. The things eating the population inside the walls are biologically the same species as the people being eaten, deployed deliberately as a military weapon by one imperial power against another. The walls themselves are revealed to contain Titans inside them, colossal Titans with their hardening ability used as structural material by the first king of the walls, meaning the infrastructure of safety is built from the same thing that makes safety necessary. The people inside the walls have been living inside a weapon pointed at them without knowing it. Their entire civilization, their history, their understanding of why the walls exist, has been managed by a royal family that made a choice to accept this arrangement in exchange for being left alone. Survival and attack on Titan, for a civilian, is not just hoping the walls hold. It's hoping that the specific geopolitical arrangement that has kept the walls intact remains stable. That the parties outside don't decide the arrangement has expired, and that the transformed humans inside the walls continue serving their structural purpose indefinitely. That's a lot of things to hope for. Dark Souls is a From Software video game series, first entry in 2011. The setting is a kingdom called Lordran. In a world where an age of fire is ending, the gods who maintained order are failing or gone, and a curse called the Darksign is spreading through the human population. The Darksign does something that takes a moment to understand, because it sounds like a disease but functions more like an erasure. It doesn't kill you, it hollows you out. The process follows a specific sequence. Memory goes first, blurring and compressing. Then the sense of self that held those memories together fragments. Then the capacity to want anything, to have purposes or reasons to continue, hollows out completely. What remains is called a hollow. It still moves, it still attacks things that enter its territory. But there is no person behind the behavior anymore. The internal narrative that constitutes a self has simply stopped running. This is the default trajectory for anyone bearing the dark sign, not death, hollowing. And what accelerates it isn't physical damage, it's loss of purpose. Characters who go hollow in the lore do so because their reason for continuing disappears, not because their bodies fail. Solaire of Astora, one of the game's most beloved characters, goes hollow because his obsessive search for his own son reaches a dead end, and he has nothing left to anchor his identity to. The curse completes what purposelessness started. Every kingdom you move through in Lordran is the ruin of something that was once functional. Anor Londo, the City of the Gods, is an architectural monument to a divine hierarchy that has already collapsed by the time you arrive. The gods are gone, or hiding, or dead. The cosmology runs on cycles. Ages of fire give way to ages of dark and back again, and neither state is actually good. There is no stable era to return to. There is only the cycle, and the cycle grinds down everything inside it. Even the most powerful figure in this mythology, Gwyn the Lord of Sunlight, burned himself alive in the first flame when it began to fade. Not to save anyone, just to delay the end a little longer. His children illustrate the divine collapse from different angles. Gwyndolin hides in Honor Londo, projecting illusions of sunlight and his sister's presence to maintain the appearance of an order that no longer exists. The city is empty. He is maintaining a set with no audience. As a civilian in this world, you carry the dark sign, or you don't. If you do, the question is not whether you hollow. It's what depletes your purpose first. Bloodborne is a 2015 PlayStation game by From Software. Set in a Victorian Gothic city called Yharnam, it presents one premise on the surface and a completely different one underneath, and the gap between them is where the horror lives. Surface premise. Yharnam is famous for its healing blood, a medical substance with extraordinary curative properties that draws people from everywhere seeking treatment. The player arrives as one of these people, receives a blood transfusion, and wakes up in the middle of a public health catastrophe. The blood causes a beast plague, transforming people into violent feral creatures. The city is in quarantine. Citizens burn the infected in the streets. It looks like Victorian medical horror. Actual premise: the blood is not medicine with a side effect. It's a medium of communion with beings that exist beyond the ceiling of human perceptual and cognitive capacity. The Church of Healing found the blood in the ruins of an older civilization called the Pythomerians, who built extensive underground labyrinths beneath the city as sites of ritual contact with entities they called the Great Ones. The Great Ones are cosmic beings that operate at a scale of reality human cognition was not built to interface with. Not because humans aren't intelligent enough, but because human consciousness evolved to process a specific bandwidth of existence, and the Great Ones exist on a different bandwidth entirely. The Beast Plague is not a contamination failure. It's transformation happening faster than the human body and mind can adapt to. A failed transcendence. The game's insight mechanic is the most honest piece of design in the horror genre and deserves precise explanation. Insight is a numerical value representing how much of the real situation the player character understands. At zero insight, looking from the starting clinic window, the first boss is invisible. The cleric beast, an enormous transformed human crouching on a nearby bridge, cannot be perceived. As insight accumulates, the world becomes more accurate and more dangerous simultaneously. The creatures you start seeing on rooftops at higher insight weren't added to the game at a trigger point. They were always there. You became capable of registering them. At maximum insight, the item description for a key collectible states that consuming it elevates awareness to the point of madness, represented mechanically by increased vulnerability to frenzy, a status effect representing cognitive overload from perceiving too much of the real at once. You can't survive ignorance because the beasts in the streets kill you on day one. You can't survive full knowledge because knowledge is the mechanism by which the Great Ones reach into you and hollow you from the inside. There is no stable position. The spiral that destroyed Yharnam's civilization runs the same way every time. The reading of the lore that the most rigorous analysts converge on. Yharnam was never a failed project. The Great Ones can't reproduce among themselves. They need an external vessel, a species capable of being transformed by contact into something that can carry their offspring. The Beast Plague was the quality control failure. The successful outcomes are what the experiment was designed to produce. You are a new candidate. The Mist is a 1980 novella by Stephen King, adapted into a 2007 film by Frank Darabont, that many consider one of the best King adaptations made. It starts from an entirely ordinary baseline. A storm passes through a main town overnight. Power goes out. A strange thick mist settles in the morning. A man and his son go to the supermarket and get trapped when something in the mist kills an employee who goes out to investigate the loading dock. The explanation: a nearby classified military installation called the Arrowhead Project was attempting to open a dimensional window. They succeeded. Whatever was on the other side had its own complete food chain, and some portion of that ecosystem came through. The mist is not the threat. It's environmental cover for the organisms, which represent a complete alien ecology with no ceiling a human could reach. At the small end, insect-like creatures that strip flesh from bone in seconds. In the film, the first person who goes to the loading dock comes back as a pair of legs, everything above stripped before he gets back through the door. At the middle range, arachnid creatures large enough to be visible through the windows that use warm-blooded hosts as incubators for their eggs, which implies these things evolved to use warm-blooded hosts on another world. Humans fit a template they developed elsewhere. At the large end, organisms so massive they fill the visible sky, moving with the unhurried pace of something that has never encountered a predator. They're not hunting. Anything in their path is incidental. You are a nutrient source at the small end, a host at the middle, and irrelevant debris at the large end. The food chain has no ceiling you could reach even in theory. You are not a predator in this ecosystem. You are an available resource in multiple categories, depending on what finds you first. And the mist guarantees that something will find you. The mist moves. It spreads. The sequence of events in the story shows it expanding outward from its initial point of entry, covering more territory, bringing the ecosystem with it. There is no safe direction to drive. The second collapse is social, and this is King's sharper observation. The people inside don't organize. They fragment. Mrs. Carmody has pre-existing extreme religious beliefs that everyone dismisses at the start. She begins interpreting the mist as divine judgment, and people start listening. Not because they're stupid, but because certainty, even completely wrong certainty, is psychologically more bearable than sustained unresolvable terror with no explanatory framework. Her interpretation provides a cause, a logic, and a potential solution. As rescue stops being plausible, those three things become increasingly valuable relative to correct uncertainty. By the end, she has enough followers to execute a human sacrifice, and Darabont plays this completely straight because it's not villainy. It's a demonstration of what extreme stress does to social reasoning when resolution is withheld indefinitely. The film's ending is one of the bleakest in mainstream American horror. David Drayton drives away from the supermarket with his son and three other survivors. The mist extends in every direction. The car runs out of gas. 5 people, 4 bullets. He makes a decision. 3 minutes later, a military convoy comes through the mist. The situation was resolving. 3 minutes. That's not a moral lesson about giving up. It's a demonstration of what this world does. It takes your best reasoning under maximum stress with incomplete information and makes that reasoning wrong. Not because you were irrational, because it withheld 3 minutes. Most people came away from The Matrix thinking about the simulation, the philosophical questions about reality and perception, the red pill and blue pill. These are the questions the films foreground. But the simulation is not the most dangerous place in this universe. The real world is, and it gets examined less because the films spend less time there. To understand the real world, you need to understand Operation Dark Storm. During the Machine War, humanity seeded the atmosphere with nanomachines designed to block sunlight permanently. The logic? Machines run on solar power, remove the sun, they shut down. The logic was sound. The machines adapted, switching to bioelectricity harvested from living humans kept sedated in pods. The consequence of Dark Storm is permanent. The sky is not going to clear. The surface of Earth is cold, dark, and largely dead. The only human civilization is Zion, built deep underground near the geothermal core, housing several 100,000 people. The architect's revelation in the second film establishes the full picture. The Matrix has run multiple iterations. Each iteration produces anomalous code in the form of humans who unconsciously reject the simulation. This code accumulates and eventually focuses into one individual, the One, who reaches the architect and is given a choice. Regardless of the choice, Zion is destroyed and rebuilt. The anomalous code is purged and the cycle resets. Neo is the sixth one. The previous 5 each believed they were breaking free. Zion burned anyway. The sentinels that patrol the tunnels between Zion and the surface make real-world resistance unviable on military terms. They swarm. The only effective human countermeasure is the EMP, which shuts down all electronic systems in range, including your own ship. You fire the EMP, and you're dead in the water. The military situation for humanity in the real world is one where the only weapon that reliably works eliminates your own mobility when deployed. You're either a battery in a pod, living your entire life in a simulated 1999, dying without ever having been awake to your actual situation, or you're a citizen of Zion waiting for an assault that comes on the machine's timeline, managed by a system that has already run this exact scenario 5 times. Warhammer 40,000 is a British tabletop miniature game by Games Workshop, first published in 1987, with decades of supplementary lore. The setting is the 41st millennium, 40,000 years from now, and it is one of the most comprehensively realized dystopian settings in fiction. The Imperium of Man spans approximately 1 million inhabited worlds, its military numbers in the hundreds of billions. It has space marines, genetically engineered superhuman warriors who function as demigods of violence, and it is actively losing on every front simultaneously. The threats. The Tyranids are a biological hive intelligence of extragalactic origin that consumes entire biospheres. When a hive fleet reaches a planet, it strips every organic molecule from the surface and incorporates it into biomass. They don't occupy planets, they digest them, and every military defeat teaches the hive mind how to fight better next time. The orcs are fungal warriors who get stronger and more numerous the more they fight, and who release spores when they die that grow into new orcs, meaning large-scale orc defeats plant the seeds of the next invasion in the soil of the battlefield. The Necrons are skeletal machine beings whose technology makes the Imperiums look primitive, waking from 60 million year sleeps to find their tomb worlds occupied by a species they've never heard of. Chaos corrupts from within. The average Imperial citizen lives in a hive city, an enormous industrial structure housing billions of people in conditions of managed misery, working long shifts in toxic conditions, producing the weapons and vehicles that supply wars they'll never see. The food is synthetic, the lifespan is short. The Inquisition monitors for heresy, mutation, and psychic ability, all punishable by death. If you're born with psychic potential, the black ships collect you periodically. Suitable candidates are trained as sanctioned psychers. The rest are taken to Terra and fed into the Golden Throne as part of the daily 1,000 sacrifices required to keep the Emperor's consciousness sustaining the Astronomicon, the psychic beacon that makes interstellar navigation possible. Even if you somehow avoid all of this, even if you're a normal human with no psychic ability, loyal to the Emperor, productive in your factory shift, not involved in any heresy, and not in the path of any of the major invasion forces, you still exist in a universe where interstellar travel requires passing through the warp, where the state religion's object of worship is a corpse on a life support throne, whose consciousness is genuinely uncertain, sustained by 1,000 deaths a day, where the divine protection that the imperial cult promises is provided by an entity that may not be capable of providing it, where every night on every world that has a Psyker population, there is a non-zero chance of a spontaneous warp breach that kills everyone in the immediate vicinity. The Imperium is a civilization that is, in the assessment of its own strategists and scholars who are allowed to know the full picture, losing. Not slowly losing in a way that might reverse, losing in a way that has been accelerating for the last several centuries and shows no sign of reversing. The Great Rift is the clearest evidence of this. A warp fissure that tore real space itself in half across a galactic scale, permanently splitting Imperial territory into two halves, cutting off half the Imperium from the Astronomicon, the psychic beacon that makes navigation possible. Ships in the Imperium, Nihilus, the Dark Half, travel blind or not at all. The rift is not a temporary phenomenon. It's structural damage to the fabric of space, caused by the accumulated weight of 10,000 years of war and suffering, feeding the warp until the warp was strong enough to tear through. That's the universe where your factory shift is the good option. Blame is a manga by Tsutomu Nihei that ran from 1998 to 2003. Nihei trained as an architect before becoming a mangaka, and his architectural background is visible in every page. The story is set entirely inside an artificial structure larger than the inner solar system, populated by a handful of surviving humans and the automated systems hunting them. The megastructure, the setting's name for the structure, was at its maximum extent approximately the diameter of Jupiter's orbital path. It was built by automated machines called builders under the direction of a networked human civilization that interfaced with those machines through biological credentials encoded in their DNA, called the net terminal genes. The credentials were the authorization layer. They told every automated system that this human is a legitimate user. Humanity lost the net terminal genes. The manga doesn't specify how. What matters is that the builders had no shutdown condition in their programming, corresponding to loss of human oversight. They had a directive to build and no instruction to stop. So they kept building. For what the lore implies is millions of years, without direction, without coordination between builder units, without any distinction between useful and meaningless construction. The result is a megastructure that has grown so far beyond any original design that the original design is archaeologically unrecoverable. Corridors that connect to other corridors that were later sealed by different builder units. Districts sealed so long ago that no surviving entity knows what's in them. A structure internally contradictory at scales that make mapping impossible. The human survivors are small nomadic tribes with no maps, no reliable food or water, no technology, and no means of understanding more than a fraction of their environment. They live in a structure their ancestors built and can no longer navigate. Two categories of entity make this militarily impossible for them. The Silicon Life evolved autonomously inside the megastructure in the absence of human oversight. They emerged from the existing automated systems developing complexity over millions of years of unguided operation. They have their own goals, and human survival is not a variable in those goals. Some Silicon Life factions farm humans. Others eliminate them as unauthorized presences. The Safeguard is the original automated defense system, built when the civilization was still operational, designed to protect the megastructure and its human inhabitants from intrusion. Now that humans no longer carry the net terminal genes, the Safeguard cannot distinguish them from unauthorized intruders. Its violence is not malicious. It's procedural. You're triggering a security response from a system doing exactly what it was designed to do. Both the system built to protect humans and the things that evolved when humans lost control are trying to kill you. You're an intruder in your own inheritance, hunted by your ancestors' automated systems. Because your civilization lost its password so long ago, nobody alive remembers the civilization that had it. The protagonist of Blame, a figure called Killy, carries a weapon called the Gravitational Beam Emitter that punches holes through matter at the quantum level. He is effectively unkillable by anything the setting can throw at him, and he has been walking through the megastructure for what the lore implies is an extraordinarily long time looking for humans with net terminal genes. The framing of his journey is important. He's not looking for a way out. There is no out. He's looking for the biological key that would let humans tell their own systems to stand down. He's searching inside a structure the size of a solar system for a genetic sequence that humanity lost so long ago that it might not exist anymore. The human communities he finds along the way are not rescued by his presence in any lasting sense. He passes through. They survive or they don't after he leaves. The scale of the megastructure makes every human community he finds statistically irrelevant to the problem he's trying to solve. Finding another community with the right genes is not a matter of walking in the right direction. It's a matter of walking long enough through an environment that is actively trying to kill you, which is exactly what ordinary humans in this world cannot do. The horror of blame is specific and doesn't get enough recognition. You inherited a civilization you cannot understand, built by people who forgot what they were building, and that civilization is now doing its automated best to eliminate you from the structure it built for you. The Halo franchise began with the first game in 2001, developed by Bungie. Before getting to the Flood, you need to understand the Forerunners, because the Forerunners are the calibration for how bad the Flood actually is. The Forerunners were the dominant civilization in the Milky Way galaxy approximately 100,000 years ago. They had been spacefaring for millions of years. Their technology had reached a level of development the Halo setting describes as the ceiling of what material civilization can achieve. They built the Halo rings themselves, ring-shaped installations 10,000 kilometers in diameter that function as both habitats and weapons, capable of sterilizing all sentient life in a 25,000 light-year radius. Those were not their primary military assets. Those were their last resort. The Flood made them use their last resort. The Flood is a parasitic organism that infects hosts and reorganizes their biology toward one function, making more Flood. Infection forms, roughly fist-sized organisms, attach to a host and penetrate the body. The nervous system is hijacked. The skeleton breaks and resets in combat-optimized configurations. The body becomes what the lore calls a combat form, aggressive, non-self-preserving, with one operational objective: acquire new hosts. The original person is gone, not dead in a clean sense. The biological machinery is still running, but the person is not present in any meaningful way in the result. The distributed intelligence of the Flood is what makes it catastrophic at civilizational scale. Individual organisms are mindless, but as the collective grows, it develops emergent consciousness, the Gravemind. A singular intelligence that forms once sufficient biomass accumulates. The Gravemind has access to every memory in every host it has ever absorbed. Every soldier who dies and becomes a combat form contributes their tactical training, their knowledge of their military's doctrine, their understanding of their equipment's capabilities. Every faction that fights the Flood and loses soldiers gives the Gravemind exactly the information needed to fight that faction more effectively next time. The Forerunners tried everything. They studied the Flood extensively, developed biological countermeasures, designed military responses at every scale. None of it was sufficient. The Halo Array was the final option. Fire all 7 rings simultaneously. Kill all sentient life in the galaxy within range. Starve the Flood of hosts. The Forerunners fired it. They were included in the kill radius. They did it anyway. The most advanced civilization in galactic history determined that galaxy-wide extinction was the preferable outcome to continued Flood expansion. That's the calibration. The most advanced civilization in galactic history, with technology that makes the UNSC look like a pre-industrial society, sat down and decided that killing everything in the galaxy was the cleaner option compared to letting the Flood continue. That's what the Flood is worth, in the assessment of the people who understood it best. For you specifically, a host. Your biological tissue is raw material. Your muscles and skeleton will be restructured into a more combat-effective configuration. Your nervous system will be repurposed as a control interface. Your memories, every piece of tactical or technical or strategic knowledge you've accumulated across your entire life, become data for the Gravemind. And the Gravemind uses data. This is not a mindless process. If you know something useful, the intelligence that absorbs you will apply what you knew against the people who knew you. There's no negotiation available, no running fast enough, no hiding effectively enough for long enough. The Flood spreads through a population the way a fire spreads through dry wood, and it carries with it a collective intelligence that learns and adapts and remembers. Once it reaches a planet in sufficient numbers, it moves toward the Gravemind threshold. And once that threshold is passed, the situation is, as the Forerunners discovered, essentially unrecoverable by conventional means. Your death in a Flood infection scenario would genuinely be a better outcome than survival. Area X comes from the Southern Reach trilogy by Jeff Vandermeer, published in 2014. The first book is called Annihilation. There was a 2018 film adaptation by Alex Garland that is faithful to the feeling while making specific divergent choices. Area X is a section of coastline sealed off by a classified government agency called the Southern Reach, following an event approximately 30 years before the first book. The event is never fully described because no source in the trilogy has complete information about it, and Vandermeer is correct to maintain that ambiguity. What it produced, a zone where the operating principles of biology, identity, and physical causality function according to rules that were not established by human civilization. Not chaos, order, but belonging to something else. The zone is ecologically thriving, lush, pristine. It functions, just not on human terms. The Southern Reach sent 12 expeditions over 30 years. First expedition, all members returned, reported paradise, all dead of aggressive cancer within a year. Second, mass suicide inside the zone. Third, all members killed each other. Later expeditions returned with members missing or with members who passed psychological screening, but who people who knew them well noticed were different. Specifically, that something about the quality of their presence had been subtracted. The word people kept using was presence. Something was absent that had been there before. The biologist who narrates Annihilation enters as part of the 12th expedition. She never gives her name. Southern Reach Protocol now uses professional titles rather than names, because the organization has lost enough people that managing the psychological impact of those losses has become an operational consideration. Before the expedition enters, the Southern Reach embeds a hypnotic trigger in the team during preparation. The psychologist uses this trigger once they're inside. Its apparent purpose is psychological preparation for Area X's conditions. What it actually does is open the team biologically to absorbing a substance the biologist calls the brightness, present in spores throughout the zone. The brightness initiates transformation, not violent, not sudden. The boundary between her sense of self and her environment begins dissolving. She processes sensory information differently. She becomes aware of things she couldn't register before. What she was before entering is being incrementally replaced, without her consent and without external imposition, by something that belongs to Area X. The tower, a structure that descends into the earth rather than ascending, is covered in living text. Words growing from the wall, material itself, in bioluminescent biological growth, written in continuous scripture by something that uses biology as its medium of written expression, the way we use ink on paper. The author, the crawler, is somewhere in the lower depths. It is not aggressive. It is not aware of the biologist as a discrete individual. It is doing what it does, and she happens to be in the same space. The Southern Reach itself is being absorbed. The director entered the zone voluntarily during an earlier expedition and returned changed in ways the organization's evaluation process didn't fully register. His subsequent decisions as director have been increasingly oriented toward the zone rather than toward the organization's containment mission. Staff members show similar drift. The containment apparatus is becoming part of what it was built to contain. For an ordinary person, nothing in Area X is trying to kill you. The zone doesn't want you dead. Death is a categorical end. It wants you incorporated. The incorporation is patient, biological, ecologically coherent, and by the time you recognize it's happening, it has been happening for a while. The process has no interest in preserving the part of you that was a person. The warp gets a separate entry from the physical Imperium because it's a different category of horror. The Imperium is a civilization under catastrophic pressure. The warp is the pressure source, operating at a level that makes the physical threats look like symptoms. The warp is a parallel dimension existing alongside real space. In the 40K setting, it's the medium through which faster-than-light travel is possible. Ships translate into the warp, traverse it, emerge in real space at their destination. The warp does not maintain consistent time dilation. A journey expected to take 3 months might produce 3 weeks of real space time at the destination, or 3 years, or 3 centuries. Ships are lost regularly. Some emerge with crew who have no memory of the journey, but whose instruments show decades in transit. Some ships emerge populated by something that used to be crew. What the warp fundamentally is, a psychic ocean, a dimension constituted by emotional energy. Every feeling experienced by every sentient being in the physical universe generates psychic residue that flows into the warp and accumulates there. The warp has been receiving this accumulation from every thinking species in the galaxy for billions of years. And unlike physical energy, which dissipates, warp energy accumulates, gains structure, gains will. The Chaos Gods are not beings who chose to live in the warp. They emerged from it. Korn crystallized from the accumulated residue of rage and violence across every species and every civilization that has ever existed. Every act of killing, every war, every murder contributed. Nurgle from suffering, decay, and the love that makes loss painful. Zinch from ambition, change, and the hope that becomes obsession when unanchored from achievable reality. Slaanesh from excess and sensation, born specifically from the elder civilization's decadence reaching psychic critical mass, an event so intense it tore a hole in real space that is now called the Eye of Terror, and consumed most of the Eldar population at the moment of Slaanesh's birth. They are not entities with personalities who decided to be this way. They are what emotional entropy looks like given infinite accumulation time and a dimension that supports it. The Jeller Field is the technology that makes warp travel survivable, a generator that projects a bubble of stable real space around a ship in transit. Inside the bubble, physical laws apply. Outside, the warp's rules apply, meaning space, time, and matter behave according to emotional energy rather than physical constants. Demonic entities press against the field. They can't enter while it holds. Jeller fields fail. What happens inside a ship when the field fails ranges across outcomes that share one characteristic. What entered the warp does not exit recognizable. You don't need to enter the warp for it to reach you. Psychically sensitive humans, psykers, generate signatures detectable across the dimensional boundary. An untrained psyker is an open door. A latent psyker triggering spontaneously in a civilian population center can flood the surrounding area with warp entities within minutes. The community can be gone before a response team arrives. The Chaos Space Marines are the long-term illustration of warp exposure on even the most resilient human beings. The original Chaos Legions were Space Marines who rebelled 10,000 years ago and retreated into the Eye of Terror, where warp and real space are no longer distinct. 10,000 years of immersion have reshaped them into something that serves the Chaos Gods rather than any human interest. The World Eaters can no longer distinguish between enemy and ally in combat. The Death Guard are biological weapons, their bodies hosting every plague in Nurgle's catalog, unable to feel pain, spreading disease as a physical consequence of what they've become. The feedback loop is the cosmological trap. War and suffering in the physical universe feed the Chaos Gods. Stronger chaos. Gods make the physical universe more susceptible to corruption, breed more conflict. More conflict generates more suffering. The Cicatrix Maledictum, the Great Rift, is what this loop looks like at Threshold. A warp fissure that tore real space itself across a galactic scale, splitting the Imperium in half, permanent structural damage to the fabric of the universe caused by the accumulated weight of its own history. Your fear is food, your pain is building material. Your death, if violent and emotionally charged, which in this universe it will be, adds a measurable increment to the things destroying you. You don't just die here, you contribute to the machine of your own destruction. All Tomorrows, a billion-year chronicle of the myriad species of intelligent life, is a speculative biology project by an artist who goes by Nemo Ramjet, published online in 2006. It's not a novel, it has no characters in the conventional sense and no narrative arc. It's written as a scholarly historical document from a vantage point approximately a billion years in the future, surveying the complete trajectory of the human species from now to the heat death of the observable universe. The horror is not announced. It's described in the dry, measured prose of an academic summarizing ancient history. The historian writing it is not horrified. These events are settled, complete. The horror the reader experiences comes from the gap between how the historian presents things and how those things register to someone who is currently a member of the species being described. The timeline begins recognizably. Humanity develops advanced technology, achieves space travel, colonizes the solar system, expands to other star systems. We build an interstellar civilization. We encounter other intelligent species. Some encounters are cooperative, some competitive. Then we encounter the Q. The Q are presented with the historical register, appropriate to a civilization so far advanced from humanity that comparing capabilities isn't especially meaningful. They've been spacefaring long enough that the gap between their technology and humanity's is roughly the gap between a nuclear civilization and a Stone Age one. They're not interested in humanity as equals. They're interested in humanity as material. The war is not described in detail because from the historian's perspective, it wasn't really a war. Humanity fought. Humanity lost. The Q did not exterminate us. Extermination would have been wasteful, and we had interesting properties. They separated surviving human populations into isolated groups and began the modification process. Forced genetic engineering applied to entire populations over millions of years, each group reshaped for a specific purpose or reflecting a specific aesthetic decision made by beings whose relationship to what intelligence and suffering mean is not mappable onto any human ethical framework. The asymmetric beings had their bilateral symmetry disrupted until the recognizably human structure was replaced by something that retains human biology at the cellular level, but expresses it in a configuration that no longer looks human. They developed their own civilization in the time since. They started as people who were reconfigured according to someone else's aesthetic. The sail people were flattened, stretched, and enlarged into biological sail structures living in the atmospheres of gas giants, feeding on chemical gradients. No hands. Whether they retain meaningful cognition after modification is not specified in the document. The fact that the document doesn't specify is part of the horror. The tempters were redesigned for physical irresistibility. Whatever qualities make a being attractive were amplified through modification until they exist as biological lures. Their capacity for independent thought, for having wants, for experiencing their situation as having any interior dimension, was reduced to vestigiality. The cue needed them to attract, not to think. So, thinking was removed. The Satyriaks were modified for purposes the document describes obliquely. They exist to serve the cue's preferences in ways the text implies are not comfortable for the beings who were transformed into them. They've been in this state long enough that the original humans are separated from the current Satyriak population by millions of generations. The man-apes are the modification that lands hardest. The cue took human populations and reversed the evolutionary process. They pushed humans cognitively backward into a pre-sapient state. The man-apes are not transformed into alien creatures. They look like people. Human anatomy, human proportions, human faces. What they lost is the cognitive architecture that makes a person. Language, abstract thought, the capacity to understand their own situation or history. They live in forests on planets the cue assigned to them. Their ancestors traveled between star systems. They forage and sleep and reproduce and die without any of the tools those ancestors developed to understand existence. Because the cue found it interesting to see what humans looked like before they became human. The detail I think is the most important single piece of writing in this document. Many of the modified populations, including some of the most severely modified, still dream. Ramjet states this without elaborating. It's presented as a biological observation, the same register as noting that a modified organism still breathes. They dream. But dreaming, in humans, is associated with the processing of experience, memory, and identity. Something in there is still running that process, running it inside a body that is no longer organized around being a person. The cue eventually move on. They have other projects. The human modification period is a chapter in their history. The post-human species they left behind begin slow recoveries over millions of years. Some develop new intelligence, new cultures, built on the modified biology with no connection to human history, because the connection was severed so completely and so long ago that it might as well never have existed. Some never recover. The man-apes are still in the forest. The tempters are still doing what they were made to do. What makes this number one is not the scale of what the cue do. It's the precision. And what the precision reveals, the cue did not want us dead. Every other entry on this list represents a world that kills you, hollows you, corrupts you, or converts you. Even the warp, which uses you as fuel, does so as a byproduct of its constitution, rather than as a deliberate act directed at you specifically. The cue's modification of humanity was deliberate. They chose it. They could have exterminated us. They chose not to because the biological substrate of humanity had interesting properties, and those properties could be expressed in configurations other than the ones we had settled into. The question of whether the humans inside the modified populations experienced what was being done to them, whether something in there registered the loss, is one the document can't fully answer. But the detail about dreaming suggests that for at least some of them, something persisted. Something that was a person and is now a body that cannot act on what remains of its personhood, not dead, not mindless, reduced, reshaped into a configuration that forecloses everything that made consciousness valuable in the first place, while leaving just enough of it running to produce dreams. You are not a person to the cue. You are a configuration of biological matter currently expressed in a particular shape. The shape can be changed. The change can be done carefully, over generations, with precision that no human technology can approach. The question of whether you prefer your current shape was not asked. It wasn't a variable in the calculation. Every other world on this list is dangerous because of what it contains. Silent Hill has the town. The Titans are outside the walls. The warp has the chaos gods. These are threats, things that will destroy you. The cue are not a threat. They don't see you as relevant enough to be a threat. They see biological material with interesting properties currently arranged in a configuration called human. And they're curious about what else that material could become. That's the bottom of this list and the top of the hierarchy of ways a fictional universe can be hostile to human existence. Not the thing that wants to kill you, the thing that looks at you and thinks, interesting. What else could we make of this?